I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jan Wong joins me again. She's just published a new memoir. It's a delicious and dishy book, Apron Strings, Navigating Food and Family in France, Italy, and China. On sabbatical from her job as a professor, Jan decides to learn how people in these three countries cook, and more importantly, how they cook and eat in their own homes. She and her 20-something son Sam head off, and it's quite interesting how they end up going, but soon they're learning about their hosts, this delicious food, and of course each other. Books about mothers and sons are few and far between, and this is a terrific addition to the genre. Jan Wong is a prize-winning journalist, best-selling author, and a professor of journalism at St. Thomas University. She's a third-generation Canadian and the eldest daughter of a prominent restaurateur. This new book is published by Goose Lane. Please welcome back to the Planta on the Line program, Jan Wong. Ms. Wong, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, it's good to talk again. And as I was telling you just before we started, it's such a good book, because if you like food, if you like travel, and if you want to look at, say, family relationships, you've got it all here, not just your relationship with your son, but these families that you stay with. It's a great insight into how people live in these three countries.
Right, because normally, you know, people do this and they go to cooking schools. And the difference is that we moved into people's homes.
Yeah.
We were in their kitchens and we had prolonged contact with them. So, you know, I got to see how their families operated, and essentially nobody's perfect. They're all very real families.
Yeah.
And I found it very interesting to go from, you know, France to Italy to China and see if they had anything in common or how they were evolving.
And so how long did it all take for you and Sam to do these three countries?
Well, we did it in under 3 months.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and we took some breaks, some sort of days off in between. But when we were with the families, we didn't take any time off.
Yeah. So I guess a great place to start is what was happening in your family at the time. Your other son, Ben, he was getting married, and you felt kind of left out of that. And so what was Sam up to?
I have two sons. Ben is the oldest, and Sam is the youngest. I mean, or I should say older and younger.
Uh-huh.
And Ben was 25 then. This was a couple of years ago when I first started the book. And he suddenly called me and said he was getting married, and I was so startled. I guess I just didn't see him at that stage in life. And I said, to who? Who are you getting? And it was somebody I had met. And I like her, but I just wasn't psychologically prepared. And then the next thing that happened was Ben said he wasn't going to have a real wedding. He was just going to do some paperwork in Los Angeles, where he's a graduate student.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay, I'm coming. Like, I feel I have to be there. It's such an important moment. And he said, no. We're just doing paperwork. We don't want you to come. And it was complicated because the bride's mother couldn't go, and so they didn't want it to be family.
Uh-huh.
And I just felt so rejected, and I felt like I had been suddenly relegated to second place in my son's life. And of course I had been, but I didn't realize second place was so far down the food chain. And I was kind of startled. It's as it should be, but one reason I wanted to write a book about mothers and sons is I don't think people are prepared. I don't think mothers are prepared for what happens when your son gets married. So I wanted to look at that. And then, of course, I chained my sights on my only remaining child, poor Sam. And he is 3 years younger than Ben. He was 22 then, and just graduating from Queens in philosophy. And he loves cooking. He'd worked in restaurants his whole time. High school and university life, and he dreamed of becoming a chef. So I started thinking about what kind of book, and then I had a sabbatical coming up because I'm a full-time professor now, and I thought maybe I should travel with Sam and learn cooking. And then I thought, how about home cooking? I mean, the idea came to me sort of gradually.
Yeah.
I played with the idea in my mind, and that's how I came up with this. And then the whole question was whether Sam would agree to go, because what 22-year-old wants to spend, you know, morning, noon, and night with his mom?
Yeah.
No one does. So it was hard to persuade Sam to do this book with me.
So Ben was the one that went to school out here at UBC, is that right?
That's right. You have such a good memory, yes. Ben did his undergrad at UBC, and he's now doing his PhD at UCLA in psychology. So that was kind of interesting, too, because he understands psychology.
Yeah. So I hate the word foodie, but...
I know. There's no other word.
there isn't. But you and Sam obviously know your way around the kitchen, or at least you know how to eat your way.
Yeah. We both are pretty good cooks, I'd say. Sam's probably a better cook than I am, although we argue about it quite a lot.
And I understand that your father founded Bill Wong's, which was quite popular in Montreal back in the day, right?
Yes, that's right. My father he passed away, but he was a very successful restaurateur. And then, you know, in writing the book, I didn't even realize that my grandmother on my mother's side also owned a restaurant, because I never thought of it like that. So really, we're several generations in the food business. And, my dad, I think he is the one who started the all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet.
Yeah.
Because I remember how he got the idea. Mm-hmm. It was from a Western roast beef restaurant in Toronto. And I remember when he went back and he told his partners he had this idea, and they were aghast. They thought for sure they would go bankrupt.
Yeah.
And so he started it. It was hugely popular. We had so many lineups. And then everybody copied it. That's what I think.
Yeah.
I haven't found a restaurant that predates my father's.
Yeah, and it wasn't just Chinese food. It was also, he wanted the roast beef. He wanted that
stuff
too,
he had
right?
roast beef on it, and he had French pastries. And, you know, so in a way, he had already started this sort of multicultural, you know, globalized restaurant.
Yeah. So what was it like to plan these 3 months or so? I mean, did it cost a lot?
Ha, good question. So, first of all, how do you get people to take you into their homes?
Yeah.
And I didn't know these people. I knew the French family just a little bit because they had taken Ben in as a student when they lived in Lyon.
Uh-huh.
Now, they no longer lived in Lyon. They had moved to the countryside. But so I knew them a little bit. I had met them. So I had put out feelers, and they responded very positively, and then I know a lot of Italian Canadians, and I sort of put out the word, and one of my friends put me in touch with Maria Rosa in a little village in Piemonte, and she didn't really want to, but my friend forced her to. he set up some Skype dates, and I learned Italian at my university. I shouldn't say I learned it. I should say I took a course in Italian. That's more accurate. and then in China, I have so many contacts because I was a foreign correspondent there that I only contacted one person, and instantly I got family. So how much did it cost? Well, I didn't know when I started out. I knew, of course, I'd have to pay for the airfare. I figured I would stay in hotels, and then I would compensate the people who took me into their homes to show me how to cook with some money for their time, and I would cover all the expenses. But in reality, it never worked out quite that neatly. So in France, they immediately said, no, you just live with us.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay, so I'll rent a car. And they said, no, we'll pick you up at the train station, and then if you need a car, you can use ours.
Uh-huh.
It's like, wow. And then when I tried to pay them, they looked at me in horror and completely refused. So all through the cooking, I tried to buy all the groceries.
Yeah.
And if we went out for dinner or lunch, I tried to grab the bill. Sam and I got pretty good at that, but I wasn't always successful.
Mm.
And then when I wanted to pay them, they said no. So I just gave them a donation for their cause, which was, they were so interesting as a family, because they took in undocumented migrants.
Mm, right.
And at the time we lived with them, they had a family from Georgia, the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, living with them.
Uh-huh.
So, and then in Italy, the woman who had been browbeaten into taking me, Maria Rosa, was so nervous about shouldering the entire burden of her country's culinary tradition that she dragooned four other friends into cooking. yeah. With me. So she wouldn't take any money, but her friends would agree, but I had to do it in a very discreet way.
Mm.
So I sort of asked them for receipts, and sometimes they didn't have it, so then I just said, okay, well, tell me what you think it cost, the ingredients, and then I'd give them that, and then I'd say, so how much, is this okay? And I'd sort of show them the money.
Yeah.
And then they just smile and say no, and then I'd say, well, I'm putting it on your bedside table. It was kind of weird, because
uh-huh.
I think that's what happens when you're a prostitute. I didn't know what to do,
because
there was no template. So I left them the money on their table, and I think everything was fine. I think everybody was happy. And then in China, this is really funny, because I didn't get one family, I got three.
Mm.
And they were super rich. So when I tried to pay, first of all, they insisted I stay with them in their home.
Mm-hmm.
So didn't pay for a hotel. And of course, as a journalist, it's way better to live with them.
Yeah.
But then when I tried to pay them, I mean, I just got laughed out of the room. So I tried to pay for things like groceries and, you know, if we went out for dinner, I'd pay.
Sure.
But it was kind of, it was uncharted territory, what I was doing. There's no template for it.
Yeah.
So I think I managed to pay when I was able to pay. But I think the message is that people become very generous when they're trying to show you their culinary traditions.
Yeah.
They really want to show you. And that's the big difference from a cooking school.
Yeah, they really are. They're marvelous ambassadors for their cooking, and they care so deeply about it that they do want to impress you guys.
But they really care.
But beyond that, you have to represent it well.
They were patriotic about their cuisine.
Right.
And they were earnest and very serious about showing us home cooking. And so it was really an interesting insight also into their local philosophies of food. So it was so different from, you know, what you might do if you were a tourist. It was really unusual. And I felt so lucky that these people opened their doors to me.
Well, does Sam tell you, as you're on, or even before you leave, what he wants to get out of this?
Well, you know, at first he's quite reluctant. He really doesn't want to because he knows. I told him I'm doing a book,
yeah.
So if you agree to come, you can't just bugger off. You can't change your mind in the middle and walk away. So when you commit, you have to commit. So he was interested, of course, in cooking. And he knew that the way it was evolving was we were going to actually be in people's kitchens and learn what they make for supper.
Uh-huh.
And he was really interested in that. And I think he wanted to improve his skills as a chef. And, you know, I think he's been with me on other reporting adventures.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't as if he was completely naive about how intense it was going to be and how much work it was going to be. So cause he knew. I worked once for a month as a maid,
right.
As an undercover maid, and Sam went with me. Sam and Ben both went with me, and I rented a basement apartment, and I was living on my earnings as a maid. And so they'd already been through that very intense experience where, they were helping me with my rags. I literally washed my rags at night.
Yeah.
And I got so tired that I would come home and look at my children. They were still fairly young.
Uh-huh.
And I'd look at them and say, can you guys wash my rags? Like, I'm so tired. And they would be helping me make dinner with almost no budget. We had very little food money.
Yeah.
So they've already been through that. And I think, you know, Sam had no illusions that it was going to be tough. But he really enjoyed it,
yeah.
And he was a great sort of co-researcher because he's male and he's young, and he was good with people. He won them over right away because he was so friendly and respectful, and he also did all the dishes, so they really liked him. And I'm probably less likable. because I'm there, you know, with my notepad out, writing down everything. And I've seen videos of myself with my notepad, and I look really scary. I never smile. I'm just frowning because I'm thinking of, what do I have to ask next?
Yeah.
Or I'm concentrating. So I don't look very approachable. But I think Sam is kind of attractive and charming. I know I'm his mother. But I think that people ended up liking him. And he was sort of my goodwill ambassador.
But you see, that's funny that you say you seem unlikable. But people talk to you, and you get so much out of them. And I'm not just talking about your work in this book, but your work over the years as a reporter.
That's nice.
That you were
I guess so.
You were able to get things from people that they probably wouldn't have given you otherwise, despite how you might have your countenance, say.
Okay, I guess
so. Yeah. But so when because there's great detail in the book about how these people live, and I know that you've had to change some of the details, but it is quite frank. And I guess Sam and Ben and Norman, they're used to you writing about them. Mm-hmm. What was it like for these families in terms of telling them what you wanted to do at the end of the experience with them?
Well, in France, I suddenly was alarmed. Actually, Sam pointed it out to me. He said, you can't use their names because they're sheltering undocumented migrants.
Right.
It's illegal. And I went, oh, no, I didn't, you know, we were already a week into it. So I talked to the family, and I said, well, I can't use your name, obviously. And that I hate to do because, as a journalist, I feel that people have, there's a credibility problem if you don't give people their real names. And they said to me, the father of the house said to me, no, it's fine. And he used to be a journalist, which I didn't realize until that moment when he told me, no, I get it. He said, I'm a journalist, I get it.
Yeah.
He's a retired schoolmaster, head of a lycée. That's all I knew him as. I didn't know he'd had an early career as a journalist. He said to me that the European court, the High Court, had already passed a law saying that no member of the EU could prosecute its citizens for helping to rescue or just help an undocumented migrant.
Yeah.
So they were not in legal jeopardy. So he said, no, don't worry, you can use it. And then in Italy, there was no problem. They were completely on board with me documenting. You know, they talked sometimes about the problems in their families, about, you know, the sister's not speaking to the brother. They told me all their problems, and I wrote it all. And part of it was, I think, I also told them about my problems with my siblings.
Yeah.
And I showed them the pictures of my crazy brother. And I think, and I wrote about it in the book, too, because I feel if you're going to write about everybody else, you have to also disclose your own.
Yeah.
Problems there. And then in China, though, in China I decided, no, I can't. So in China, that's where I changed the names, and I changed a few identifying details. If I thought the person's job was so specific that if I wrote the name of the country that he controlled the real estate development funds for, then people would know. People would instantly know who it was. So I had to change a few things. But, you know, it's fine because I'm talking about Shanghai, a city of 16 million people.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of anonymity built into that.
Yeah.
But I just felt I couldn't do that in China. So that's the section where I changed the names.
So throughout the book, Jen, you reflect on mothers and sons and explore that relationship. I mean, it's something that we haven't read in very many books, if at all, in recent years.
Right.
I'm curious to know, having done this trip with Sam, do you have any wisdom that you come away with as to how this relationship is and what it means, I guess, for the both of you?
When I was researching this, I found almost no books on mothers and sons.
Hmm.
Trevor Noah has written a wonderful book about his relationship with his mother, And there's another book that I read, and I can't remember the name of it. It's about a son visiting his mother as she's as she's dying. She's dying of cancer, I think. So those are the two books that I can think of. But I don't remember reading much about mothers writing about their sons. And I said, so what are the lessons? The lessons are that it's okay. You can actually travel with your son. And if you can set up something to do together, and I'm talking about a young adult son,
yeah.
I think an older son would be fine too. Like somebody in their 30s or 40s might be able to go out with their mother. And it's a very important time, and it should just be the two of you. And find an activity that you like to do together. I mean, you don't have to go far.
Yeah.
You can just go away to another city for the weekend, or you can go, you know, go, if you both like hockey, you can go and get hockey tickets in another city and go watch a couple of games together.
Yeah.
But there's something very special about the mother-son relationship, which isn't explored enough. And I think it's something that we're not prepared for. I don't think sons are really prepared for either. And so if you can just, my advice is to try to think of something you can do together with your son that involves more than 24 hours.
Mm.
Like just spend some time together and talk about things.
Yeah.
Like ask your son, are you happy? Or what makes you happy about your life right now? Or what makes you unhappy about your life right now? It's good to talk, but you can't just land on him and, you know, start peppering him with these questions. You have to spend some time together and then talk. I think otherwise life just passes you by and you never ask these questions.
Right. So you obviously know Sam a lot better than you knew him, say, before the trip, and I guess he could say the same about you, right?
Right, and I think we were fairly close before the trip,
mm-hmm.
but after the trip, almost, and I would say he's almost closer than a husband would be. I think sons are much more attuned to their mothers than husbands are to their wives.
Huh.
Because if, like I write this in the book, if a wife says to her husband, oh, sure, honey, go ahead, watch 3 hours of football tomorrow, she actually is being sarcastic. She actually means, don't you dare even think about that. Well, the lawn needs raking and we need to put up the Christmas lights,
yeah.
right? But if I said that to Sam, he would know right away I was being sarcastic.
Yeah.
He would get it. He would start to laugh, and he would say, yeah, right. So I think that, I don't know why, that's what I think. I think sons are closer to their mothers psychologically.
Mm-hmm. So what has Ben thought of the book?
Ah, that's interesting. I think Ben, I let him read the stuff about, I usually never let anyone read things in advance.
Uh-huh.
Sam got to read the whole book because he was supposed to comment on it and fix things if I got something wrong. And originally we wanted him to write a separate section, but he didn't produce enough copies. So we just took some of his, the editor took some of his thoughts and she wove it in. But with Ben, I let him read the section that I wrote about him and his wife because I was a little worried.
Yeah.
And I normally never let anyone read anything before it's published, but I thought, oh, I guess I better let him. And I think he liked it. I think he took out one of my jokes about vegans. He said, I think you've said enough. He said, because you see, my daughter-in-law is a vegan.
Yeah.
And she's also gluten intolerant, so I made a few jokes about how I'm a vegan intolerant omnivore. I think that's what I said. So I took out, like, one joke, but I fought for my others, and I finally managed to convince Ben that this had to stay in. But, you know, that whole idea of writing about your family, I think even some of the bravest writers won't do that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think it's, families are where the truth lies. So if you're trying to write nonfiction, families are very important. I just think they're important to write about. But I know that most people won't touch their families.
Yeah. But you've done that throughout your career, though. You've written about you and Norman living in China, and you've written about, you know, abuse that you've had, you've experienced as a child, and you know, you've written about Sam and Ben, you know, throughout the years. So do you think you're braver than others?
Oh, maybe I just have less material. I think they're used to it.
Yeah.
I know I had colleagues at the Globe and Mail. I had a wonderful colleague, John Alamang, who wrote a fantastic column about his family.
Uh-huh.
It was just one of the best columns. But as soon as his kids were able to read, he stopped. He told me, I don't want them to read what I'm writing about them. and I thought, what a shame, because when they learn to read, it gets even better, right?
Yeah.
But even Nora Ephron wouldn't write about her children. She wrote about her sister.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, I can't write about my sister. She would kill me. So yeah. I guess we all have our vulnerable spots. But my children have grown up with this, and I think they just ignore me. And the dirty secret is I don't think either of my boys have read any of my books, except Sam had to read this one because we needed him to comment. But I don't think they've read anything. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, but what's the experience like if people meet them and they know stuff about them?
Yeah, they sort of... I think they're so embarrassed to say they haven't read it that they just sort of smile shyly and change the subject.
Do you wonder, Jan, if you had a daughter or daughters?
Yeah. I wonder all the time what it would be like. I look on my friends who have daughters with quite a lot of envy, because I think it's a completely different relationship. And the daughters, you know, do things that women like to do usually, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can do things together. Whereas with sons, I think you have to figure out things that they like to do, and you have to do it with them. I'm just lucky Sam likes to cook, and I like to cook. But, you know, my older son, Ben, he likes parkour. Well, I don't think I'll be doing any parkour anytime soon. So I think daughters and mothers are close, but they also are in much more conflict because they're the same, right?
Yeah.
With sons, we're kind of opposite. So we don't have as much conflict. That's my theory, but of course I don't really know. I just see the mother-daughter relationship from the outside looking in. It looks pretty good to me, but I don't really know what it's like.
The other thing that I found interesting, you mentioned a moment ago about not being conscious of how you look to other people. But,
mm-hmm.
but in the book you talk about how people view you, and there's a moment where you're in France. And you want to talk to a chef who owns a restaurant, so
right.
you want to get details. And
Francois says to me, you look Asian, it's okay.
Yeah,
they'll talk to you.
Was that one of the first times that you were conscious of looking foreign to other people?
It was the first time in the process of doing this book that it occurred to me that I'm committing a reverse cultural appropriation.
Mm.
It was... Of course, in my life, I felt that I looked different. I mean, just growing up in Montreal in the 60s, I was one of two Asian families at my primary school.
Uh-huh.
And then in my high school, it was essentially all white. I think there was one other Asian family, and there was one black kid, and that was it. It was all white. So I've always been conscious of it growing up. But in the course of the book, it suddenly occurred to me, people who look like me don't write about French food and Italian food. You know, we usually get slotted into, like, our Chinese food.
Uh-huh.
And that's when it occurred to me. And I realized, I have to address this. Whereas people who are not Asian feel very free to become authorities on Asian food. So I thought, well, at least I'll be doing something, something for the cause of globalization and multiculturalism.
Yeah. Like, I'm Filipino. My parents are Filipino, I should say. I was born in Vancouver.
Yeah.
So it never occurs to me sometimes the way I look and how people look at me.
It never occurs to you?
Yeah, very rarely. I mean, if I'm going, you know, like I'm interested in American politics and American history. If I go to an American city or like a museum somewhere, a presidential library, people will be surprised that I'm actually interested in this stuff. Just by looking
right.
at me.
Right. So that means you are reacted to by other people who think that the way you look means you shouldn't be interested in this.
Yeah.
And you do get it.
Yeah,
sure you get it.
Yeah, occasionally, but yeah, when I do get it, it does.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you mean. You're saying you're startled.
Yeah.
I am too.
It really does startle
me. I'm startled because I forget what I look like. I just am busy wandering around. Looking at things, asking questions, and I'm always taken aback. It's so funny. I went to a movie on the weekend. I went to see Victoria and Abdul, starring Judi Dench. It's about Queen Victoria's relationship with an Indian fellow who was brought to England for her, I think, her Diamond Jubilee.
Yeah. Yeah.
And afterwards, I was in this elevator, tiny cramped elevator, because the friend I went with couldn't walk down the stairs. And so there's just four of us, and this other couple turned to me, and the man said to me something about, wasn't that a great movie? And I said, yeah. And then he added, I'm a member of the Monarchist League of Canada. And I looked at him and I said, well, I'm not.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what to say, because I think he just assumed I would be full of praise and affirmation. And I looked at him and I thought, I'm not a member of the Monarchist League. Are you kidding me? Look what they did to the rest of the world. And then I think he was quite taken aback that I didn't admire him.
Yeah.
But he just thought he could tell me that and I would just be, I don't know, a mute audience. And I would smile back, and I didn't. I just said, well, I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how these things, they just come at you, don't they?
Yeah, they come at you, and afterwards I thought of many things. And then something, he said something about the Constitution, and then I was still so taken aback that I forgot to say, wait, but Canada doesn't have a Constitution. I think I talked about the monarchy, and then he started to say, well, it's in the Constitution. And, of course, he's completely wrong.
Yeah.
We have the Charter of Rights.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was still talking back to him, you know, 10 minutes after he had disappeared. And, you know, the idea that constitutions are not infallible, that's why we have amendments in the U.S. to the U.S. Constitution. There's, like, the 14th Amendment. So, but you're so surprised when people react to you, because you don't walk around thinking that you look different.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when somebody reacts to you, you're kind of dumbfounded.
Yeah.
You don't have a chip on your shoulder because, you know, you had a pretty good life in Canada. So you don't have a chip on your shoulder except the moment when somebody does treat you as the other.
Yeah. You mentioned the name of the newspaper that you once worked for, but I noticed in reading the book that it's not mentioned at all. Was that deliberate?
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I don't feel like writing the names Globe and Mail in the book because I don't like the way they treated me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they fired me when I was clinically depressed, and I think that's wrong, and then they went after me.
Yeah.
So I deliberately didn't put it in, but I mentioned it because it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, and so I occasionally mention it, but I try not to give them any publicity.
Right. Yeah.
So why would I put them in my book?
Right, right. Yeah. And that's a wonderful book, as I was telling you before we started, Out of the Blue.
Thank you.
One of the best books I've read.
In that book, I had to name them.
Yeah, you did.
What's about workplace depression.
Yeah, right. What's next for you? Are you working on something else now?
Well, I think I'm going to write the final chapter, the closing, the real denouement to Out of the Blue.
Mm.
Because after it was published, the Globe came after me, and they dragged me back into arbitration.
Right.
And because they were so unhappy with the book, especially when it made their own bestseller list. So I've never written, because I was tied up in litigation for 2 years, I never wrote what happened. It's just, I think I can write it in a chapter, And I'm going to put that online on my website for free.
Yeah.
So if you've already bought the book, now you know what happened afterwards.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to do that next. I was kind of busy with this, with apron strings,
yeah,
because I had this sabbatical. So I think that's what I'm going to do next.
Yeah.
It won't be too hard. It's just I have to get out all the legal documents and go through everything that happened. But I think that's what I'm going to do, because I think that needs to be told. It's all about, you know, it's very timely right now, this idea of non-disclosure agreements.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Harvey Weinstein, when he paid people off, he got these non-disclosures. And
yeah.
So what happens is people never find out what really went on, because
yeah.
they gag you.
Yeah.
And I fought really hard to be able to tell my story at the Globe and Mail, and I got that right. But in signing that agreement that gave me the right, the company put a non-disclosure on the agreement itself, and that's where I got caught.
Yeah.
So it was very Machiavellian, and I was still very sick when I signed that, and I just didn't see it. I just didn't get it. And it's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
You know, lawyers are not very helpful sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
They don't do their job properly, so I had that problem too. But I also had really good lawyers.
So. Well, we'll look forward to that, but, I mean, until then, I mean, Apron Strings is such a beautiful book, and congratulations on it.
Oh,
and,
thanks.
And it's been such a pleasure to talk to you again. You know I'm a big fan, so this has been fun for me.
Oh, thank you very much.